for us to vote today.
No, I don't, we don't go for that. We got nothing to get bills on for. Labor and Business Affairs Committee coming order, let's take note of the press. John Bill 440. Keith, you want to explain the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for record, my name is Keith Wilson, Chairman of the Workers' Compensation Board. In compliance with the chairman's instructions, Tuesday, we conferred, the board, members of the board, conferred with representatives of self-insured group, and also conferred with Mr. George Burney regarding some of his concerns, and Mr. Jerry Mendel. We have for your consideration a proposed amendment to Senate Bill 440, which we've had drafted following a conversation yesterday with self-insured group and the others that I mentioned. In effect, what the amendment does, it gives the board authority to deal with a certain self-insured depending upon whether or not their plan for processing claims out of from an out-of-state location is satisfactory, their performance is satisfactory, and gives the board the right for cause to revoke permission if the employer fails to comply with the rules. Provision made in this amendment to allow 60 days after order of revocation to file an appeal and have a hearing on the matter. Also provides that if it's necessary to perform audits out of state on such this type of employer, that the expenses of travel, expenses of that audit will be paid by the employer. This follows the practice that is prevalent and has been for years in the insurance department for out-of-state auditing. And altogether likely that if, as, and when we get into this part of the program, that it would be necessary for us to appear before the emergency board to take proper steps to get this authority to travel out of state and to receive, on the one side, an expenditure limitation, and on the other side, to have show a credit for receipt for this type of thing, comply with the requirements of our state budget process. I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, whether the opportunity was provided before to explain just briefly. I have written testimony that's been distributed to you, as well as a copy of the amendment. In essence, what we're doing, what we're asking the legislature to do in Senate Bill 440 is to require those who provide and write workman's compensation insurance to be here in the state, keep their claims here, keep records of the guarantee contract here in the state, and keep their records here so that we can manage them and regulate them. We've encountered a great deal of difficulty. Fortunately, only among a comparatively few insurers and employers over the years who attempt to administer their claims processing from an out-of-state location. It's difficult to keep them up to date on what our rule changes are, specifically the retroactive reserve formulas and things of that nature are very complex and difficult. It's comparatively easy to communicate if they're close by here in the state where we can call them and talk to them, or they can come down and meet with us, or we can go to their office. But we've run into some very serious problems. Not of those who tried to administer their claims from out of state. Generally, these are the ones that have very few claims, very few accounts. And this is an effort to beat this process up and to see to it that they comply with our law and our rules. The timeliness of first payment, as an example, there's just no good reason why first payment can't be made to an injured worker within the 14 days provided. But if those checks are issued in the east, just the sheer time it takes for the mail to travel sometimes causes those payments to be late. And we feel that this is a very appropriate and proper measure to reinforce the authority of the board and to improve not only the board's performance but the insurance company's performance. It does, of course, also provide that there are service companies who do this service for out-of-state entities, and that's acknowledged and deemed appropriate under this bill. It also has one other important feature, is that in the safety compliance or safety consultant program that is charged to the Workers' Compensation Board under Accident Prevention Division, I think it's obvious to everybody by now that because of budget limitations and one thing or another, the board is never going to have what some people consider and what we consider an adequate staff to do this important work for employers in this state to consult with them on safety requirements. This bill provides that insurers and self-insured shall furnish this service to their insured under a plan that is approved by the board and monitored by the board and audited from time to time, so that we're sure that the insured are getting the service to which they're entitled. I should say that a lot of insurance companies and a lot of self-insureds are doing a real fine job at the present time in this area, but there are others who are not. And I have a distinct feeling, it may be unfair, but that there are certain insurance companies in the workers' compensation in this state that feel that their obligation ends when they collect the premium dollar. And this isn't my concept of what their obligation is. I think they owe a lot for those high premiums that are being charged in this area of working with their insured to cut down the frequency of accidents and to confer on consultant type problems. With the consultant staff that we have in the Workers' Compensation Board, it will provide a cadre of well-trained people who can work closely with these other people, and thus amplify by 100-fold the number of people who are active in the field in safety consultant type work. Be pleased to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any more?
Basically, you've got two distinct different parts of the building. One is paperwork, self-employed, the other is consultant.
Yes, that's right.
Now, in 6.1, it says the effect on the expenses is insurance, because if it's dependent upon the retirement, you need to work in compensation board, so the compensation would be compensation service. I can't support the bill because not on the merits, but on this aspect of it. I think we need to know something to what it's going to cost to provide the service. Have you and your delivery thought about what kinds of requirements that you might put upon the case?
Yes, we have evaluated already and are well acquainted with the program the state already has in this area, Representative Morris. And we think it could well be used as a model for other states, for other insurers.
Those requirements be comfortable with the
Certainly. Oh, at the moment, I'm not sure. I don't know how that legislative picture could
happen. I think they don't want to vote for something, so I don't know what it's going to cost.
As I mentioned a minute ago, the, by and large, a lot of the insurance carriers, including states, have a very fine program of safety consultants now. And we don't intend to spend our time except to use those people as examples in formulating our minimum requirements.
How serious the problem is with employees, the feeling that if they look at state consulting services, that they're going to come right back with a mandatory inspection and then get wrong. That's pretty.
The problem is with the board wearing a black hat on the one side and a white hat on the other, not state. They have no reticence and no reluctance to call state consultants because that they don't fear an inspection for compliance as a result of that. But they apparently fear, they've been trying to overcome it, but they apparently fear calling a board consultant in because they all work for the board, consultants and the compliance officer. And unfortunately, for a while at least, we felt that they were not using our people as much as they should. We think that gradually this is being overcome and they're making better and more use of our people than they were in this one. But there was a fear at the outset that this was occurring and we did run into that problem. I think it's gradually being overcome, but we can only sell to the Ways and Means Committee of this state, of this legislature, of Cadley, of say 5 or 6 people consultants. And it's just obvious that 5 or 6 people can't do the type of job that should be done.
These are people you already have.
Yes. We would like many more, but we don't.
Talk about it.
There's other amendments here, and our best chance is going to require that they keep their records in the state. This will allow them to ask for it to be out of state.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about a lot of people want to do this now? Or
No, we think it'll be compared with few that's been cut that will apply under this particular amendment for this authority. And we're going to have to be convinced that they can do the job if they get the authority. But it only applies to very few.
Is it
to his own medical report consensus. I'm not sure what the practice of the insurer is. I've never heard of a case where they were denied except in the case of a report which is stamped confidential not to be shown to the claimant and the area of psychological hang-ups and mix-ups and things of that nature. Many times those are deemed confidential and not released to the worker unless, but may be released to his attorney or a representative, where the idea is that they may be damaging to the man. Our records, of course, are public records, and we accumulate the claim file there, so that if the attorney wants any portion of those, he's entitled to them anything.
In regards to responding to the question, that comes right out of the claim file.
For the consultant,
right.
Yes, the insurer himself, the present plan, present system is that we, in our action prevention division, have a line item allowance of several line items for consultants. That program is funded 50% by the federal government and 50% by our administrative fund, which is a levy on the insurance premium.
It's not the only fund.
No. I don't know what more I can say, Mr. Chairman, in regard to Representative Morris's problem. Would be perfectly glad to work with the committee on the cost impact. All I can say is that the by and large, the vast majority of insurers will not notice any additional cost impact because they already have a good program of safety consultants, including safety. And that's why I realize that's a broad brush treatment of your concern.
Broad brush
of your concern. Representative
Davis. These claims, you want to put them in state. Do some insurers process by computer, and therefore they wouldn't normally keep the files in the state if they had an office out of the state?
I don't think the computer is involved, Representative Davis, in this particular regard. The claim files are actual documents, and they do some computer work in bringing the cost of claims going forward and things of that nature. But that isn't particularly involved here. We have no problem with that area. It's just the documents themselves.
Any further questions?
All right, thank you. Thank you.
Any of the other insurers here that you heard on? Amendment to 440?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is George Bunny, and I represent the American Insurance Association, which is a trade association of capital stock companies, and a number of them, like workers' compensation business in Oregon. We are opposed to the bill. The bill really has three aspects to it, the first two of which are taken care of in Section 2. And we have no objections to that, the maintaining of offices here or the engagement of the staff or independent contractors to take care of these problems. It is from Section 3 on that we do have our problem, and that is in the area of furnishing advisory services, counseling services, and occupational safety and health. Of course, the private carriers do that, as Commissioner Wilson has stated, but he nevertheless, through this bill, wishes to have this aspect of workers' compensation insurance furnished both by the state and by private companies and by self-insurers jazzed up. Now, we have no objections. In fact, we pride ourselves in having the highest order of safety service and consultation services in the industry. And that was one of the reasons why a two-way bill was put over and adopted by this legislative assembly some 10 years ago in the first place. It is the manner in which this subject is to be administered that we have met yesterday with the board and asked for some changes, all of which were denied. And we feel that since it cannot be made, that we have to oppose everything from Section 3 on out on the bill. The first problem that we have, and the first objection that we have, is that you notice in Section 4 that there is an injunction now, there's an addition to ORF 731.418, which requires the insurance commissioner to revoke. Not the Workers' Compensation Board, the Insurance Commissioner, to revoke the certificate of authority if he finds after a hearing
Then on the top of page four, that the insurance company failed to comply with subsection one or subsection six of section six. Section six is the procedure for applying for and securing of and performing the safety program aspect of the bill. On the other hand, in addition to the authority which the insurance commissioner now has, there's also the authority in section nine of the bill, vested with the state industrial action, with the workers' compensation board, to impose fines. Now, the workers' compensation, the insurance commissioner operates under a theory that he's going to impose his penalty only after a hearing. The Workers' Compensation Board, I was told yesterday, doesn't work that way. It has no hearing until after the fact. The fine is imposed, one charge is notified of it, and notified also of the fact that if he wishes, he can have a hearing. And then if he does, well, then the hearing follows before a hearings officer of the Workers' Compensation Board's system. We feel that's not really adequate safeguard for preserving the rights of the private insurance company. Nothing like that, which is contained in the insurance code, where the penalty is levied only after a hearing and a finding by the insurance commissioner. We have some doubt about the procedures by which the form of safety programs are to be approved. This bill would require that all of them be submitted in advance to the Workers' Compensation Board for approval. And we think that would be burdensome, and we think that would be better procedure both for us and also the board, which maintains audit of these programs on a regular basis, to simply pick up any error by its auditing system, and it certainly would be less expensive. Section 6 contains the bulk of the provisions for which we want to levy our objections. We also feel that my client is composed of a bunch of nationally based corporations. They operate in most of the states of this country. They have field representatives that do safety work that travel from state to state. We are hesitant, and due to the broad language of the bill and the sparsity of any restrictive language or language of definition, we are a little hesitant to proceed on the basis where the state of Oregon might, in the future, claim that some of our safety people are not qualified in Oregon because we haven't passed some Oregon examination which Oregon might impose. Actually, the insurance industry engages in, according to our figures, 75-80% of all of the safety engineering people in the nation, and they have perhaps the largest reservoir. And we feel that we wouldn't want to have a state that would be geared towards a completely local administration and local approval of safety people impose these additional regulations and requirements on us. Now, Commissioner Wilson hastens to assure us that he has no such intent. And I know him personally, and I know that he has no such intent. But safety is a matter of a little flux in this legislative assembly now, and the authority for it may be moving to another state administration, and we can't know what's going to happen. We just feel that we'd like to have something in the bill which we can commence with. We'd also suggested that to the board yesterday that in this area of regulations, because the board does have the power of regulations concerning aspects of safety, that we would like to participate with the board in making these determinations.
And the commissioner has also assured us that he would certainly invite that. And one of the reasons for it being that our personnel is eminently equipped, well equipped, to proceed and to give this assistance in the right of these determinations and make these solutions. And that the board would really wish to proceed in a manner for the insurance industry safety people would to go along with it in making the determination. Yet we've asked that that be included in the bill, and we feel that because the bill, not in and of itself, fails to provide for insurance safety people, but as one of the cumulative aspects of it, that the fact that it doesn't, which makes us a little uncomfortable in view of the state of flux, safety in this case, would prefer to see an advisory committee established, which would include representatives of the private carriers and states, among others, to advise and work with the commission of the board on safety. So our recommendation, Mr. Chairman, would be that if the bill passes, that everything from section C on out be eliminated and keep section 2, which contains the requirements that have been burdensome to the state administration, namely of keeping the reporting process in a place where business is done in this state. Thank you. Mr. Rogers. Well, section 4 is existing law, which has been modified by subsection 6. Subsection 6, it contains the new materials that subsection 4 then picks up and puts into the insurance code. The violation.
Section
6. Oh, pardon me. I mean section
4.
Section 6 is right, yeah. We have some mild objection in the way penalties are assessed in section 9.
How many of your clients currently have this type of service they are performing in or this section of compensation?
I would say that I asked that question of the people I represent just the other day, and virtually all of them that operate in this state have this service in this state. There are something like 10 or 12 of them that do not, and they do not have any part. You're talking about the health complicated complications. There'd be more than that. I was thinking of this. Record keeping and keeping the records in the place. Maybe about a half of them would have their services come from headquarters in California, Consultative Service.
They do provide it in the state of Oregon.
Yes, as far as we know, they do provide it, but it's probably not in the manner that, and that I don't know, Mr. Rogers. I don't know the extent to which they do provide it. I heard Dick Miller yesterday of the compliance section state that he thought that the small grocer who buys workers' compensation insurance should have these compensation services, and we agree with him. And we want to see to it that they're available to us. We have no objection to that portion of the bill which requires that these services be furnished. Our only objection is the manner in which they are approved and the safeguards that we might have in connection with the inauguration of that program and its operation.
So you have no objection to this response. Your objection is in how it is going to be implemented.
Right. And that's right. In the manner that I mentioned.
Do you have any objection to this bill that you think that?
Yes, I have them. I wasn't going to submit them because we felt that, I hadn't planned to submit them. My plan was this, Mr. Rogers. I was going to submit them at the time of our hearing season. And then we agreed that perhaps we'd save a lot of time by having a conference with the Workers' Compensation Board with respect to these amendments. I had furnished them copies to you. We met Wednesday morning for a couple hours, and all of them were rejected. All of them. And so we feel there's really no basis to go forward with these at the present time. If they were accepted, then we could accept the bill. The Workers' Compensation Board. Not this committee now. So I have them. If the committee would wish to entertain them, I have no objection to propose it.
I would not see. Now, if I'm going to accept the mine, the objection there is no hearing prior to the accepting of the mine, and I will hear you for there. Do you have any proposed amendment to accept the mine?
Yes, we do. Yes. The group of amendments that I submitted, the Workers' Compensation Board, include the amendments to Section 9 by which this would be done. One of the complicating aspects of this thing is that it's difficult for me, and I'm a lawyer, kind of a lawyer anyway, reading this bill to determine whether or not the Workers' Compensation Board is under the authority of this the Administrative Procedures Act. Yeah. And Cliff Allison says that it is in part, but the part that we're talking of is not, and he feels that the board's own procedures that I'm saying here, and those would be the ones that they use. So we feel that those are not adequate. We think that we'd like to, if we have a violation and are in violation, we'd like to know that so that we have a chance to put on our case before the determination is made.
I would agree with that. I would like to see, for example,
I can, I have them right here if you wish to see them. I've given away so many copies that I have only two left. But the amendments that we have to Section 9 would be on page page 7 of this long sheet that you have. And it would provide that after hearing and so forth.
Now, I suppose that's absolutely
not my point. That's
right. We're not going to be able to act on this today anyway, because we want some other tax costs. So these amendments basically do what you want them to do.
Yes, they do.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, sir.
I could we ask the Workers' Compensation Board to comment on whether the amendments are the amendments to
Mr. Chairman, we have no objection to most of the content of Mr. Burney's proposed amendment at all. It isn't a matter we just object to their being incorporated in their length in the statute. Under this bill, we have the obligation to propose and have adopted the administrative rules after the public hearing. And much We feel that Mr. Burney's concerns can be and will be taken care of very adequately and almost completely in the rules that we anticipate adopting at the public hearing. But we do not feel that they're appropriate for inclusion in the statute itself. As far as the hearing is concerned, we can go either way. We can either put it under the Administrative Procedures Act, or we can handle it in the way that we do under an ordinary workman's compensation matter, which is an exception to the Administrative Procedures Act and subject to a hearing. Our ordinary procedure in these situations is propose a penalty. If it's not acceptable or can't be accepted by the person who is accused of being in violation, then he has the right to the hearing at that point to contest it, and the burden is still on the board to carry the burden of proof in a hearing of that type. So we're perfectly willing to work hand in glove, as I told Mr. Burney yesterday, and there's no problem about that end of it. But basically, our objection is to including it, making a matter of statute rather than administrative rules. Satisfactory, then hearing, if it isn't accepted by the person charged, he can request a hearing for one of our referees. At that point, it goes, if that isn't satisfactory, then it goes to a court of appeal on appeal. Or we can adopt a procedure in which the charge is made and it be suggested to a hearing and appeal to the board. That's the ordinary workman's compensation route, which is laborious. I'm quite sure that we would opt to go the administrative procedure route. That would then follow precisely the type of procedure that we use in safety violations, which is citation and safety. Informal conference is available and hearing is requested.
I think we should pass the running again. emphasize that our concern perhaps goes out of the four corners of the bill. Because over in the Senate, there's a bill of expectation in the hands of the Department of Labor. And the states are going to stay in where it is. I don't know that even the city will. But that bill may pass. And we feel that we'd be going into sort of another area, and we want to have these safeguards. Well, we'd be going to an unknown situation. We work with the board. We have a very cordial relationship with the Working Compensation Board. We feel that it's doing a good job, and that including safety, and we feel that we get along with them. And they're always reasoning the board is still constituted, and both by the statute and by the personnel, it's readily available. Talk to them, and it's a real problem. Very cordial relationship and very fine working relationship. But there's others in the background that probably are something.
I heard you say that earlier that you're something concerned about the possible insurance discrimination for your
representative
for the people.
Well, we don't, not that they can't qualify, we just don't want them. We are, put this way, Mr. Rising. We have a few representatives working for an insurance company that is resident in California, and he covers Oregon, Washington, and California in areas of certain types of industrial cases. He's not a resident of Oregon. By regulation, it may be required for that man to be a resident of the state of Oregon as a prerequisite to be furnishing this type of service in the state of Oregon. That's what we're worried about. A resident job. Then he has to live there.
I can't say it isn't so. We don't anticipate ever going to any such requirement as that. Our safety consultants are not college graduates, most of them. Most of them came up through the ranks of labor and learn what they know the hard way. This is the type of people that we anticipate, or they can be college graduates as far as we're concerned, or they can be out of state residents or whatever. All we're interested in is seeing that they know what they're doing and that they're doing the job for their insurers. Now, I can appreciate Mr. Burney's concern that someday some bureaucrat may say, well, this man has to have a PhD, he has to have 10 years experience and all this type of stuff.
And have to live in Oregon.
Yes. But I think those matters just come down to good common sense, and when just the scrutiny of the public hearing with the recourse that's available, if your rules are not reasonable, and particularly with the now laying on as a legislative council, to see to it that the rules are according to the legislative intent and so forth, that there's ample safeguards to see that some bureaucrat someday doesn't get this carried away and lay on such a fund.
That's one of the problems. There's no problem with that unless it be done. But the and that may be the type of thing we will be confronted. That is they're going to have to pass examination and to practice law in this state. They have to live in this state. So the requirement is residency as well as passing examination. We don't think that's applicable. Say we have a factory with a chemical work. And whether or not safety, the problems with safety requires knowledge of chemistry and chemical engineering. There's going to be a follow. The only guy that can do it is going to have some expertise and sophistication and quite a bit of formal education.
You can't just have those three, 48 states to use, but maybe there'd be one plant in Oregon and three plants in Washington and one in Idaho. That's the kind of problem we're concerned with. But the fellow's going to be competent in California, and we feel that he'd be competent here because chemistry is chemistry, and chemical engineering is the same, and all these states are respected to the boundaries, unlike practice of law. And in some cases, I'm not going to try to get together.
John?
Now, you mentioned that if you're going to adopt a rule and you're going to do something, you have two choices. You can either use your own rules or use the administrative procedure rules. Is there any particular reason? Now, just so I have this straight, now it's obvious that a claim or something isn't handled under the administrative procedure rules. So you have, you're exempted from them for handling matters of the individual claim. But when it comes to regulations of individuals, then you have a choice of going either the administrative procedure rules or another set of rules you've developed yourself. Is that right?
I'm not too solid on that. I don't believe that is quite accurate, John. Cliff, can you comment on that? I personally, in our municipal procedure, would like to adopt the Administrative Procedures Act.
Well, maybe I should ask you, would you be satisfied if these matters were taken care of under the Administrative Procedures Act so we don't have to set out a whole new statute the way you propose, and then we also not subject to their rules that are different? Would you be satisfied with that?
Well, you want to be satisfied with that? Well, he did ask me what I want. No, we would do further. We just have a citation to the Administrative Procedures Act on that particular question.
You have anything?
No. Well, let me ask you the question. In the issue of compensation, which is subject to the recovery from compensability, that follows the compensation procedure. And all others, where there's no procedure provided, that follow the Administrative Procedure Act. We have adopted the Attorney General's model rules. We conduct our hearings and rulemaking as part of the Attorney General's model rules. We have modified the Administrative Procedure Act to some extent in the Accident Prevention Division. To this extent only, we issue a citation, penalty, proposed penalty, gives the employer the opportunity to contest. If you contest it, it goes to the referee. The referee's order is the final order of the board, and that is appealable directly to the Court of Appeals. If it was a straight Administrative Procedure Act, there would be a hearing. If the board did not conduct the hearing, the referee would conduct the hearing and have to prepare a complete abstract. The board would have to review it and then issue the order, which is the order that is the appeal to the Court of Appeals. This procedure here would follow the Administrative Procedure Act, because this type of thing is not contemplated under the Workman's Compensation Law. So whether you reference 183 or don't reference 183, we would follow it. Our concern is that we see no point in having a hearing first. After a thorough investigation and record and so forth, you can prepare if you take a formal complaint or petition and say, here that led the fact that they write your charge. If he disagrees with that, he has the right to a hearing. And we see this was a much cleaner procedure. For example, under the payment, and we would have to be having thousands and thousands of hearings if we couldn't go this route. So the due process, though, he has the absolute opportunity to be heard if he so requested on the proposed
when you. It's that citation the nature we're talking about and what they're concerned about. Is that as an analogy like a traffic ticket when the cop is giving you a ticket, you write $17 bail on it, and if you don't want to contest it, that's what the, are you in? Is it a similar situation?
Well, I refer to it as the nature of a criminal penalty with set forth back on the day on the basis of which the penalty is the right for the amount of the penalty.
They're saying, he was saying that it looks like they're trying to keep the he felt that they were trying. kind of find in advance, and it was kind of foreclosed at that time.
No, it's a proposed penalty in advance, but in force of fact, was it based on it? You then request a hearing, the burden's on the agency to go forward and prove and approve the case, and so you had it in the hearing, and you don't want to keep it.
This is their procedure that they adopt now, which they follow. And what's going to happen? They will see the change. And we think that a simple reference to an existing type procedure and the initial procedure that could have all at rest.
Yeah, that's right. If we are the board is created, operates on 656. Under 656, we are obligated to use the Administrative Procedure Act, but I think 656704, another decision is not covered in the ordinance, but we have adopted the Attorney General Law rules. But if on Section 9, or inform him if we were to say, if we just add in accordance with ORS Chapter 183. And if we read it like that, then that would solve your problem. Would that solve your problem instead of having to putting all this other language?
Solve our problem. Yeah.
So, could I suggest that if on line 12, just add another language in accordance with ORS Chapter 183, on page 5, line 12, just add.
He's looking at another bill.
Okay. Your Honor, repeat that.
I just said under Section 9, starting 12, after the serious penalties and theft, here under will be in accordance with ORS Chapter 183.
That doesn't make it optional for the board if they can't choose any other way.
It's not optional.
No, but that'll.
Where was this at?
Line 12, page 5.
Oh. You just proposed that that amendment language. I'm sorry, I was looking at
county. The best here under will be in accordance with ORS Chapter 183. I think that's what I did.
Anything else?
Thank you. Thank you. We'll probably have this back up. If we want to get some funding, Jerry, do you have something to say?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. I would like 2 points.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Mendel, and I represent the American Mutual Insurance Alliance, the trade association of mutual insurance companies. And we are opposed to Senate Bill 440 for these reasons. On Section 2, page 2, about keeping records, I should call the attention of this committee that there are 41 companies providing workman's comp insurance in Oregon, licensed by our insurance commissioner, who write less than $50,000 in premiums a year. Obviously, it is impossible for those companies, from simple financial reasons, to maintain an office in the state of Oregon when they say their premiums are less than $50,000 a year. We would not oppose that the board wishes it, if any of these companies who do not have an office here, as far as any records or any information they want, give us a reasonable time, say 30 days, to produce them, and if they don't do it, to impose a penalty. That is perfectly satisfactory with us. But what you would actually do, this would prevent 41 companies providing insurance in Oregon, and our experience with workers' comp, the more competition we have, the better off we are. Now, the other point that we are objecting to is the page 4, and just safety, I might start right out by saying all insurance companies maintain, and it's not out of the goodness of their heart, I'll be honest with you, but maintain good safety programs. We do it for a very simple reason. Accidents cost us money, and but we do it just for our own own good, as well as the good of the employer and his workers. But what we are afraid of is granting to the Workman's Comp Board the power to adopt a rule or regulation, and there are absolutely no standards or guidelines of any sort contained in this bill as to what that program will be. And you could not come into Oregon until your plan was approved by them, and we have nothing to guide it by. And prior legislatures have found that when you give such a power to administrative agencies in the state of Oregon, quite often that administrative agency and their rules and regulations are not in accordance with what the intent of the Oregon legislature was. And that's why it was the bill to give the legislature a right to review. I don't think right now we have no objection to present members of the board. They're fine, we get along with them. But who knows who it may be in 1982 or some other time. And they could adopt the regulation. And about hearings on regulations, they are not effective. Many times an agency will, in effect, adopt that regulation and go just through the procedure of a hearing. And you know very well, no matter what's said or what's done, that regulation will be adopted. I'm very happy to answer your question.
Before you get going, Jim, if anybody is here waiting to testify on anything below 502, we won't get out of this morning, because we have to go in session at 10. We'll be lucky if we get to 502. Pardon? We're here in 37 next. Right.
In premium. Yeah. Yes, I mean, impose a penalty if they did. As a matter of fact, right now, they were regulated by the insurance commission very strictly. I think that'd be workable. Sometimes an old claims file, even from our large companies here, like the big ones even, after a file gets closed, they do get sent back to maybe their headquarters, and sometimes a file of 10 or 15 years ago might be a little difficult to locate, yes, but that might be unusual.
Representative Rogers?
I wonder, who handles the claim
for the employee? Well, as a matter of fact, it isn't too difficult to handle a claim. In other words, if a person is injured, the claim is made, and you go to the doctor to get paid, unless there's an appeal goes, and then it would be, if there's an appeal, then we have an attorney here in Oregon to represent him.
So the claim actually goes to the company.
Well, the claim goes to the employer too, you know, and to the workers' comp board. It goes to the home officer insurer and to the employer, and then also to the workers' comp board. It's filed there. Actually, they don't have any trouble on the claim part. What I understand, talking to Keith and Wilson, it's been on the about the money on the payments to the board, like on the retroactive reserve and so forth, about the way of completing. That's simple. If they dispute what the company sends them, all they have to do is write them. That really isn't any problem.
Who sells this company? Is it a foreign-based broker?
Well, if it's sold here, unless it's from a national concern, it might have been sold in the home office. There's some company that does business in all states.
Anything else?
Thank you very much, Jerry.
Anybody else care to be heard on 440? I'll be on 440. I have the cleanest idea. You want, Max, you want to call Attorney General and tell him to come on in? Senate Bill 37.
Isn't it against the law to tear people's things apart without their consent?
I don't know, not.
We're logical with these.
Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 37 is some amendments to the Oregon Deceptive Trade Practices Act that was essentially enacted in 1971. We had a previous act that was completely overhauled in 1971, made a much more comprehensive consumer protection statute than it here before had been. Many of the provisions were taken out of a model act proposed by the Council of State Governments, and also another model act proposed by the Uniform Law Commissioners. And this act is enforced by the district attorneys and our office. We have a consumer protection division consisting of 6 investigators, 2 lawyers, clerical and other support, and we are, of course, operating.
Oh, don't click that door, Jeff. Shut that door, please.
We, of course, operate on a statewide basis. These amendments, like any new act passed in 71, this is comprehensive. We've had to make some refinements. We had to make some last session. And these are a few that we believe should be made at this time. The first amendment is to 646, section 1 is to 646.608, which is the basic Deceptive Trade Practices Act, spelling out the practices that are illegal under the Act. The amendment is to subsection M, and this was a subsection that was a holdover from the old statute. It related primarily to the problem of that had arisen of a number of complaints, particularly in the furnace repair industry. Well, of course, we have had other problems of a similar nature where services are performed on
somebody's goods they are not authorized by the owner, and the purpose of this section is to make that clear that at any time the services are performed on a good that you just gave to the owner without his authorization, then that does constitute a violation of the Act. Under the present Act, the only type of violation is where it is to a household furnishing, appliance, fixture, machinery, or a vehicle, and the work is done at the residence of the owner. One of the principal areas, obviously, is in that is in the repair industry, where you take your car in or a television set in, and services performed on it is not authorized in the first place. We do have a number of complaints in this area. We are usually able to reach them under other provisions of the Act, but we think it would be this would be a real improvement in the statute there. The amendments on page 4 are purely technical in nature and do not have any substantive effect. The amendments on page 5, however, are of substantive importance. The first is the question, and I thought I'd better really explain the procedure under the Act in order to understand the amendments we're proposing. Under the Act, we do not, if a violation comes to our attention as a result of an investigation, we are, as the procedure requires us to make a demand upon the person against the charge is made, and to outline what corrective action that we desire that he take, and if he agrees to take that action, then he simply signs what is called an assurance of voluntary compliance, and that is then lodged with the court. It has the effect of being a consent judgment, is what it amounts to, or a consent injunction. And there is no penalty attached to it. It is merely an injunction against him, but if there is a subsequent violation, then it is a contempt of court, and heavy fines can be imposed. One of the problems that has arisen, or one of the problems we are concerned about, it has been our practice in demanding assurance of voluntary compliance to generally to require restitution. Generally, we have never had any objection to this, but there is some question whether we really have the authority to ask for restitution. And the amendment to 3A makes it clear that we do have the authority to ask for restitution. We also, oftentimes, require provisions in the assurance of voluntary compliance that there be certain record keeping so that we are in a position to monitor that particular salary to ensure that he is complying with the order. And let me say that this is merely gives us authority to ask for this in the assurance of voluntary compliance. If the person who is against the charge thinks that we have been overly broad in our charges or asked for too much restitution, he simply refuses to enter into the assurance of voluntary compliance. We then have to take him to court, and if the court finds that our assurance was overly broad, it can actually award attorney's fees to the defendant. To the plaintiff, pardon me. Well, no, be the defendant. But that's the purpose of subsection 3A and B. Subsection 4 is merely a statement of present law, just moving the language at the top of the page down the new subsection. Subsection 5 is quite important to us, although it has not been a frequent problem, but we have had two or three occasions where this has occurred. And that is where we have the seller who is repeatedly violating the Act. We feel that the basic theory of the Act should be that every seller should have essentially one free bite, that he can, the penalties are not going to be assessed on him for a first violation, but if we have a repeated violation, we think that we should be able to go into court And that is, and so we have provided that if there is more than one assurance of voluntary compliance filed within a 2-year period, we can go directly into court. He can be assessed penalties by the court if there, if we prove the violation was willful. We have also provided, under the present law, if there is a violation of the assurance of voluntary compliance, it does constitute a contempt of court, and the court can assess penalties up to $25,000. If we go into court and we prove a willful violation, I want to emphasize the word willful, however, we can only get a penalty of $2,000 assessed. The bill in Section 5 makes it clear that the penalty would be the same in both cases. I think that sermon covers most of the provisions of the bill. The change in Section 6 of the bill, originally we had made a major subsidy suggestion regarding this statute, this is the installment sales statute. The change here now is merely technical. The power that is in the deleted subsection we would have under any circumstances, there's no reason to decide it in the statute. It cut down the length of the ORF.
Yes, ma'am. If you gentlemen just came in and here to testify on 503 or 179, there's no way that we can get out this morning. Reverend Morris?
Get number 5 again, please.
I want to make sure of it. Okay, yes. The important change is in sub 3. Where we go into court, which is very seldom that we actually go into court. The circumstances under which we can go in is where the defendant refuses to assign an assurance of voluntary compliance. Secondly, we can go in an emergency situation. Thirdly, under the bill, it provides if there had been a previous assurance of voluntary compliance and we're now going in on another type of violation, then go in. And if we prove that the violation was willful, the court can presently assess a penalty of up to $2,000. This would provide now that it could be up to $25,000. Remember this, the court's going to accept that penalty. We don't set it. And it's an amount not to exceed. And I think you've got to be able to impose, in certain circumstances, you've got to be able to impose pretty stiff penalties. In most cases, by the student. Right.
Okay. Now, have you tried to order restitution on
that? We generally do, as a matter of practice, it is.
Clarify.
To make sure that we have that authority.
Yeah, that.
No.
Have you ever got a fine and maximum of $2,000 out of this one?
No, in fact, we have never really had to use that particular provision. We have had two contempt proceedings. One of them was McGlenn Turner, and we frankly abandoned it because there was just no chance we were ever going to get any money out of it. My assumption is it's all gone to some Swiss bank account. It's more the, you know, our basic philosophy in enforcing the act is in preventive in nature, to spread our resources as far as we possibly can, and we think we can get the problem corrected. But it is always good. You get people's attention more.
When you threaten with $25,000.
Right, right.
Okay, well, you just steer a smaller town.
John. On page 3 in section M, where you get away from household furnishings and
right.
I'm real concerned about business here in industry. Are you having, I can't imagine, for instance, that you really want to apply to Teledyne Watson, that you're worried about somebody going in there and dismantling their real estate without their permission. I mean, are you primarily concerned here with consumer protection?
Well, yes, of course.
In other words, are we setting it up here where we're going to have, where you're going to be regulating repairs on docks? You don't want to get involved in that. So I'm just wondering if this is overly broad. I mean, are we really talking about residential real estate and residential, and my washing machine as opposed to, I just wonder if we're getting involved.
I would have to get out the, I'm sorry, I don't have the ORS here, but there's goods and real estate are defined in the Act as essentially consumer goods.
Oh, okay.
On section 3, or page 3, section M there, can you give me an example of possibly a
same claim? The typical example, and we have been able to deal with it because there's usually a misrepresentation element involved in it. But the typical example is somebody takes his car in and service is performed on that car that's not authorized, and then they tell you, we need a whole new set of spark plugs or something else. I mean, it's that kind of operation. It doesn't happen that frequently, but just once in a while we do get it.
How would the real estate one work then? That would have to be on the...
That had to be on your own property. The only reason we were conforming to the language we've used all the way through this act. Last session, it was in the 1971 act, it only applied to goods and services. Last session, the act was expanded to cover real estate.
Okay.
Well,
thank you.
Well,
thanks, Brad.
My only reluctance to that is frankly, I think that's a trespass. If that sign is up there, and I think that's the landowner, of course, has the right to keep people off his property, and likewise, has the right to call the police. I'm not sure that my agency has the resources to enforce the trespass all over the state of Oregon. That would be my only reluctance about it. If we had a firm that was doing it, that was operating on a statewide basis and continually disregarding that type of thing, we could probably deal with it. But as they were doing it as a matter of practice, because usually it would be a matter of the individual salesman.
You know,
part of the 71
door
Act,
to door.
Well, one of the more significant things we did in the 70, which was part of the 71 Act, was the cooling off period, door to door sale.
Any other questions?
Oh, pardon me. I'm sorry. Gentlemen, I do have one small amendment.
Good thing we have you all to take care of each other. Of course, I have to admit that Representative Morris took care of the committee this morning.
This amendment was brought to my attention by, you know, walk clerk and our staff, and you know, as far as we can understand, what it is, if you go to page 2, line 17, that particular subsection does not include the misrepresentation as to quantity. And the Model Act, from which this was drafted, included that. In fact, the Act I've seen included that. We tried to trace the legislative history, and as far as we can see, it was probably just a printing error, or somewhere in the drafting, the several drafts that went through, we got left out, and we'd like to include it.
Representative Morris moves to adopt the amendment. Attorney General's Office, page 2, line 17, search quantities between benefits and oil. Agnes?
Aye.
Representative Wolfer.
Yeah, on page 3, line 7, at the end of the line, do you really need thereof? I don't know how to figure anything. Do you need it?
No, we don't really need it.
Well, in that case, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to delete the word thereof. And the
Agnes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have only one objection to the bill. We worked with the Attorney General on the Senate side, and the bill, other than the one section which I want to discuss with you, is acceptable to us, affordable. And let me say about the operation of the Act itself, it has, in our opinion, worked well. We think it's done what the legislature intended that it do. The Attorney General's office, I think, has exercised the responsibility well. And as a matter of fact, deceptive trade practices are being brought under control as this legislature intended it. And as a matter of fact, several of our members, or my members, have in fact had deceptive trade practice or assurance of voluntary compliance filed with the office. So it is operated across the board against the large, the small, the medium size, wherever they found that kind of a practice, they have exercised this authority. We have one and only one disagreement with the bill that now stands. It is on page 3. Lines 4 through 7. The existing Act is one of several deceptive trade practices listed in 6466. 108, and relates to household furnishings, appliances, or fixture, or any machinery, mechanical device, or vehicle at a residence. I think you can read the text of what I've given you, but let's get down to the middle of it. By deleting, in our opinion, the specific act at a residence broadens unduly the coverage of this subsection to all services performed on goods wherever performed. This will include all repair shops from autos to razor repair. I hate to go back into past history with this committee, but in the shop licensing bill, you got into the question of authorization. What constitutes authorization? Under the Act and under the section that you have before you, it's at least presumed that the person who is the owner or apparent owner of a residence is going to be there and can in some manner control the activities of the repairman or the person who's doing the work. When we expand that into the repair shops, where you read the goods to be repaired, what constitutes the authorization to proceed? I won't belabor the issue. I think you'll remember it. I think only Mrs. Zarelli was not privy to that, and I don't think she missed a lot. But I'm having to go through it. We have a suggestion to make, and it's kind of a twofold suggestion. We would, and then our amendment would simply be that line 4, page 3, after any, we insert goods or real estate. In line 5, we would restore the word at, and in line 6, we'd restore a residence and delete goods or real estate, and then the section would read, perform services on or dismantles any goods or real estate at a residence not authorized by the owner or apparent owner thereof. This would, in fact, expand the activity under that subsection to include not only the things listed, but gardening, home improvements of all kinds, ripping, siding, but still within the area of at a residence when not authorized by the owner or apparent owner thereof. Now, I understand the Attorney General's concern about wanting to have some way under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act of getting at repair shops. And we're not resisting that. We believe that he should have used his authority under subsection F, which is at line 24 of the bill, which says engages in any other unfair or deceptive conduct in trade or commerce. That's broad. And then you come down to the bottom of the line at line 22. It says no action or suit should be brought under paragraph F of subsection 1 of the section unless the Attorney General has established a rule in accordance with the provisions of chapter 183, etc. In other words, he was given some open-ended authority. Or in the alternative, we think that the Attorney General should have come back with a specific deceptive trade practice to aim at and to pick up activities in repair shops, which his department or the people working in that section of his office have determined to be in need of control. But we still think that section M should only be opened up as far as we've suggested, and that you ought to approach the question of repair shops more directly and not just lump it all in together. I've talked to the Attorney General about this. I know he will resist that suggestion. We still think it's a reasonable one.
Any questions? Yes, Attorney Davis.
You might have stated already, Tom, the reasoning behind it. Can you repeat it again? What are you changing by? Well, I hear you're changing the same from the residence. What happens when we go to the service station and not find that?
Well,
we can get adopted administrative rules right now, through the way it was.
There are some deceptive trade practices that will get at the shop. go over E, F, and G on the prior page, represents that the goods or services have sponsorship, approval, characteristics, ingredients, uses, benefits, and now quantities or qualities that do not have, or that a person has sponsorship, approval, status, et cetera. In other words, misrepresentation about the kind of thing they're doing, use are, represents that the goods are original or new if they have deteriorated, altered, reconditioned, reclaimed, used, and you can't use used parts, et cetera. Represents that the goods are of sufficient standard, quality, and grade. So that they're not exactly unable to get at repair shops. They do. We do not again disagree that there is something broader. We're really concerned about this matter of authorization. The Attorney General will tell you that the facts will speak for themselves, that it's got to be an overt act. We suggest that where you bring something in which is beyond your own technical capability to know what's wrong other than the fact that it's not working. When you leave it, we think that perhaps you're going to wind up with a somewhat open-ended kind of arrangement in terms of the authorization which will be requested. And if it becomes unconscionable, obviously, in terms of what the repair shop did, it won't hold up. But where unconscionable begins and ends is kind of difficult when you're talking about activities in the range of $20 to $30, $40. And yet you can have ups in there of 100% and still not be what most people would consider unconscionable. We think the question of authorization is more difficult than the Attorney General suggests. But we do believe that it ought to be expanded in terms that it should not be tied down to furnishings, appliances, and fixtures. That's too narrow.
Any further questions? Thank you, Tom. Anybody else care to be heard on SB 37?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Meeker. I represent Senate District 15, the better half, which is Representative Wolfer.
Well, we do represent on my side.
Senate Bill 155 has kind of an interesting history. And I would like to tell you a little bit about it because it is one of those kind of bills that corrects a problem that I'm sure many of you have had or may have been a part of in 1973. In 1973, we passed a law which allowed individuals to break goods in their home and take them out here to the farmers market and sell by obtaining a domestic kitchen license from the Department of Agriculture. We did that because the previous law would not allow anyone to bake bread or homes or products in a domestic kitchen. It was prohibited by law. So we changed the law to allow for the people to bake goods in their home and sell them in a farmer's market. Well, typical of perhaps a mistake on everyone's part, and the law says, and if you'll read up there in section one, and not talk about the bold language, you'll see that no person shall operate or participate in the operation of any bakery without a bakery's license. Well, as it turned out, the Attorney General, interpreting this law, said that if you baked a pie in your kitchen and took it down to the Methodist Church and sold it in the church store, you had to have a domestic Christian license, which costed $10. Well, you sell a pie for $1.50 and it costs $10 for the license. the Attorney General issued an opinion on the law. The Department of Agriculture in a circular distributed the opinion and went in every weekly newspaper in the state, and my phone began to ring. The Girl Scouts, the Boy Scouts, the Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Church, the American Legion, virtually everybody was on the telephone. I don't know if any of you got any of the calls, but I was inundated for about 3 weeks. People saying, you mean I've got to have a license to put on the annual Amity Methodist bake sale? And it went on and on. And the answer to the question is yes. So I immediately called the herb man who was in the director of the Department of Agriculture and said, is there something we can do about this herb? Good Lord, you know that's not the intent of legislature. The bill went through both ag committees, House and Senate. And we went back to the case and said, this isn't what we wanted to do. So we prevailed on the Department of Agriculture and the Attorney General's office to issue a supplemental opinion, and there have been no less than four Attorney General's opinions issued on this particular section of the law.
And they all say something different.
And they all say something different. I would point out, Mr. Chairman, that the bill before you was reached in an agreement during the interim by the Department of Agriculture, Legislative Council, and the sponsors, that we had to do something to correct this deficiency because we are really overlooking the statute by as it's currently written and not requiring a domestic fishing license for those people who want to participate in search bake sales and those kind of things. So what the bill does, if you can look in section one, we have the same proviso that you have to have a domestic fishing license except under certain conditions. And those conditions are outlined in sub two. A license is not required for a domestic kitchen type bakery that is operated on behalf of a nonprofit institution or is otherwise not operated for profit. And then we catch the problem that the Department of Agriculture recognized might occur is you might have a distributor who could come in, and that's been taken care of by operators for profit and every distributor. And another section of 65 defines a distributor. There's a representative of the Department of Agriculture here who can advise you of any technical nature of the bill. They support it in its current form, and I think it does correct the deficiency that we created in 1976, along with the Department of Agriculture and the Attorney General. I'll respond to any questions.
I don't have any questions.
C-155 for the D-Pass. Any volunteers? This will be a good representative for Ellie, Jerry. She's new on the committee. 502. No, we're not
here to deal with you for questions.
That's the worst thing, to get asked 20 questions. Let's go ahead and get up. Simmer down, or we're going to be here till this time next year.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Frank Healy, Corporation Commissioner, and I'm here to talk on Senate Bill 502. It's a simple bill. The purpose of this legislation is to exempt margin transactions from the interest restrictions of the usury law. Mr. Kurt Olson of Foster Marshall Company is here to reply to any technical questions that members of the committee may have. Basically, this problem arose a year or so ago when interest rates reached the 14 and 15% level for the prime rate. As you know, when an individual purchases securities on the margin, then he borrows the money for the balance of the purchase price. Generally, these transactions are executed on the New York Stock Exchange and executed in New York. So a conflict existed, or a question was raised here with respect to Oregon broker-dealers whether or not they could accept margin transactions in view of the interest rate that exceeded the 10%. Some of them went on the basis that the contract was interpreted in accordance with New York law, so could execute the agreements at the higher interest rate. Others held to the 10% limitation and, of course, incurred some loss. So the point of this legislation is to exempt margin transactions from the restrictions of the usury law. I don't think that type of investor is a very sophisticated investor who's knowledgeable on all aspects of both the securities market, interest rates, and that type of thing. So we don't feel that he's the type that needs the protection of the usury law. And this essentially is an interstate business. It has to be executed in Oregon and in New York or one of the other major exchanges. I think basically that outlines the purposes of Senate Bill 502, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions, and Mr. Olson will be glad to respond to any questions.
Any questions? And Mr. Olson, do you want to just verify what he's saying, or do you have anything to say, you two?
My posture is identical to that of Mr. Healy. I think that the margin investor is a knowledgeable investor who is aware of the fluctuations in money rates, of being able to price what that he must pay for money if he makes the decision to use the margin privilege, and he thinks that is the way he is for the reserve. Something that is better to lose control over himself. I feel like Mr. Healy, that he doesn't want to be denied the use of margin because of a safe usury level that sovereign brokers to deny him. And he's going to pay the margin rate, which is generally about 1% over the call money rate in New York. Put that into the place to make an investment decision.
That's on the offer?
I have a question. Did your company say, I'm just trying to set a balance? No, we do not. I just do. Team Leverage are doing that.
We don't encourage clients to leave a set of balance, but it isn't a mean fund for us.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move Senate Bill 502 for
the Senate Bill 502 to floor to be passed. Any other questions?
Other than that, I'm not that upright. I'm all different. I haven't been told. I won't go into it now. But if all you find out for what you can hear is good, you can go to the hall.
Well, we like to pay more interest, but no.
Representative Rogers?
I would support the motion before I could have done all the things that came out. That's one
of the questions. Okay, any further on the question?
Well, could I make just a comment? I think probably John said that if the guy's into it and has to go through all the hassle getting the margin account, he's in there speculating using margin, and he doesn't know what he's doing. That's his problem. The interest of whether it's 10% or 14% or 16%, it don't make any difference on how well he does if he doesn't know what he's doing. Negligible sort of thing.
One question. Anybody put in this position and unscrupulously and not being aware of what's going on?
When you come into you go into a brokerage firm and you say, I want a margin account. And they'll say, first of all, they'll want to know how much you make, what your approximate net worth is, at least my company does. They want to know whether you have the resources to be able to handle it. They want bank references, and if the broker doesn't know you, they're going to check them. the rules coming down from up above. I don't know what they all are, but
in the first place, if you know what a margin account is, you're not in a position you're going to get stuck.
Yeah.
I don't even know what a margin account is. Take care of that.
A margin is where you can borrow money from the brokerage firm to buy securities, and the margin percentage is set by the federal government. Well, So right now, if you got $10,000, $10,000
tomorrow.
Okay. All right. We'll do it. I'm sorry.
Anything further, Agnes?
The answer to the question is the certain lending law you must comply with the version of school to the back to the margin.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, wait a minute. While the same two people are here, they're the same ones that want to speak on 503. Maybe we can hear the speaking of that. Representative Wolf will carry. We'll only take 5 minutes on that one. Maybe we won't take 5 minutes on this one.
I think we can wrap it up, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 503 makes multiple amendments to the limited partnership law. This bill resulted from a study by the Corporation Partnership Law Committee of the State Bar, and Bob Lefkowski of our office is here in the event you want particular questions or a section by section review. But generally, a limited partnership is something halfway between a general partnership and a corporation. And in order to form a limited partnership, you file them with our office, the Corporation Division, and the certificate sets forth the names of the general partners and sets forth the names of the limited partners. The limited partners have limited liability, as does a stockholder in a corporation. The general partner has full personal responsibility. The purpose of this legislation generally is to apply the same rules that we have for corporations to limited partnerships with respect to the appointment of a registered agent. The limited partnership has been a growing vehicle in the last few years because it affords certain tax advantages to being an investor. And the purpose of this legislation is to require that a limited partnership designated file with our office the name and address of a registered agent, and that they maintain a registered agent for the purpose of service of process or being contacted on behalf of a limited partnership. This applies both to domestic limited partnerships and those partnerships doing business in this state but formed under the laws of another state. And this law contains authority to resign a registered agent, the necessity to replace the registered agent, and that gives us the authority to remove the limited partnership from our records in the event they fail to maintain the registered agent. So in that way, we can keep our files current and have up-to-date adequate information for the public generally. And this requires annual reports of the limited partnership rather than every 5 years. So in that way, it helps us to keep our files more current. Now that generally, Mr. Chairman, is what this does. If there are any specific questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Representative Wolfe.
Yes, sir. An increase in fees is $10 to $25.
Yes.
That's $25 a year.
A year, yes.
From the $10 to the 5 years.
Yes.
Okay, and the second thing on your thing here with a foreign corporation or foreign limited partnership, that would not affect you had a limited partner within the limited partnership who happened to be a foreign entity.
No,
he
does not have to qualify.
I haven't read this right.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else here to be heard on 503? Okay, the hearing is closed on 503. And we're adjourned at 2 o'clock. Everybody won't have an hour here. House Labor and Business Affairs Committee come to order. First, take note of its members present. And for the benefit of the audience, as we are way behind our agenda on the floor of the House, I would question very severely whether we would get beyond, if we get that far, Senate Bill 645.
This is our 230 one. I doubt very much if we could get beyond that. As a matter of fact, I doubt if we get to that. If when our presence is requested on the floor, we go. So we'll start in on Senate Bill 179. And Ralph Payton.
I am Ralph Payton, president of Crater Lake Lodge, Incorporated. The seasonal operation at Crater Lake National Park. I operate a hotel, cabins, restaurants, cocktail lounges, service stations, boats, buses, and so forth. A member of the Oregon and National Hotel Association, a member of many tourist-oriented associations in the Northwest. Today I'm not speaking officially for any of them, but I feel secure that I represent their feelings. I understand that this new bill has already passed the Senate with only 3 dissenting votes, but without adequate hearings, and I wonder if today your committee has adequately notified all of the affected people and industries in advance so they could be here today to sufficiently prepare statements for a fair hearing. There is a Fair Labor Standard Act, a federal one that is, that has been in effect for many years and was amended May 1st, 1974. It's called PL 93259. The original law was enacted in 1938, and the hearings have been held continuously at the federal level by all segments of labor and industry to make it a balanced law that is fair and equitable. I'm going to list below some of the exceptions from the federal law that affect Oregon industry. Any employee engaged in a bona fide executive, administrative, or professional capacity. Any employee engaged by any retail or service establishment, with some exceptions. Any employee employed by an establishment which is an amusement or recreational establishment, if A, it does not operate for more than 7 months in any calendar year, or B, during the preceding calendar year, its average receipts for any 6 months of such year were not more than one-third of its average receipts for the other 6 months of the year. Any employee employed in catching, taking, propagating, harvesting, cultivating, or farming of any kind of fish, shellfish, crustaceous, sponges, seaweeds, or other aquatic forms of animal and vegetable life, or in the first processing, canning, or packing of such marine products at sea, or as an incident to, or in conjunction with such fishing operations, including the going to and returning from work, and loading and unloading and performed by any such employee. Any employee employed in agriculture. This phase of the law is loaded with exceptions, unless its operation is a large corporation or conglomerate. Any small weekly and semi-weekly newspaper in publication. Switchboard operators for small independently owned telephone companies. And Oregon has a lot of these in rural areas. Any employee employed on a casual basis in domestic service, employment to provide babysitting services, or any employee employed in domestic service employment to provide companionship services for individuals who, because of age or infirmity, are unable to care for themselves. Rather than list all of the law, suffice it to say that the federal law goes on to exclude, in certain respects, transportation, mail carriers, air carriers, canneries, packing plants, frozen food plants, and others in this category. Buyers of dairy products, seamen, drivers of public transportation vehicles. Any employee, other than an employee of a hotel or motel, who performs maid or custodial services. who is employed by an establishment which is a hotel, motel, or residence, and who receives compensation for employment in excess of 48 hours from any work week at a rate not less than 1 1/2 times the regular rate for which he's employed. Or any employee of a hotel or a motel who performs maid or custodial services and who receives compensation for employment in excess of 48 hours in any work week at a rate not less than 1 1/2 times the regular rate of which he's employed. Most employees of television and radio stations, salesmen and mechanical parts, trailers, boats, and aircraft. Many local delivery drivers and helpers. Most employees engaged in irrigation projects. Most agricultural employees. Most small country grain elevator operators in small towns. Transportation of fresh fruits and vegetables. Taxi cab operators. Food establishments in connection with private clubs or private catering. Public employees in fire or police work. Live-in maid or household servant. Now I could go on and on with exceptions and exemptions, such as fields of learners, apprentices, students, handicapped workers. But read this, it is all in the federal law. The fact is that federal law, even in its exceptions, has severe problems, even to such well-known charitable organizations as the Salvation Army, St. Vincent de Paul, Goodwill Industries, and others. Their problems of hiring handicapped workers at the federal minimum wage level has forced many of their recipients to go on welfare, and that should not be the goal of this committee. SB 179 was hastily passed in this session without proper public hearing, and only three dissenting votes because its bill of only one line sounded harmless. It sounded like it would bring Oregon up to the federal level, but in fact, it would put most small industries well above all surrounding states at a time when these small industries are already in trouble. Bear in mind, all big business in Oregon is already covered by the federal law, and this proposed law would not affect them except to give them an advantage over small companies trying to make a living. The federal legislature took years and years of hearings since 1938 and still changes the law annually where considerations are apparent. And I find it difficult to understand how this committee can hold hearings and recommend passage of a law of this magnitude when they intend to adjourn in a couple of weeks. I would suggest that SB 179 be tabled for a biennium until all segments of industry during the next 2 years can be heard or they'll be hurt. My knowledge of most of the above accepted industries is limited, but I do know what would happen to the small operators in hotels, food, beverage, and service industries. In many cases, the industries that have exceptions, except those that are short and seasonal, are not too concerned about the minimum wage as such as they are in the overtime provisions for time and a half over 40 hours instead of 48 hours under the federal law. Many of these are dealing in perishable products, and overtime would destroy the value of the product. I thank you for the opportunity to meet with you, and I'll attempt to answer any questions. But please remember, I'm a small businessman and not a lawyer.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Payton, I got from your testimony that I felt we were covering somebody else in the bill. We were going to the Fair Labor Standards Act. Yeah, using the Dean Bill property, all we're doing now is increasing what I use in the bill, and it's going to put it
right.
The bill now just increases the minimum wage from its current to $2.10 an hour and 75 and to $2.30 an hour thereafter.
Well, that's my understanding, but it doesn't. All industry in Oregon is covered by two laws.
Mm-hmm.
We have the federal and the state. and everybody has to meet the higher of the two. Now, just to raise the law to the federal level without including the exceptions in the federal law, I think is unfair.
So you're saying by raising this, we're going to have all these other people fall under the law?
Well, let me speak for my particular situation. Okay. My minimum was raised last year from $1.25, I believe, to $1.75. Okay. This year, you're proposing to raise it to $2.10. But under the federal law, because of the seasonal nature of the business, I'm excluded. But I still had to meet the higher, which is the state level, at $1.75. Our operation basically is 87 days. I have 18 feet of snow up there. And I would say that virtually 75% of the people in the tourist-oriented food, beverage, motel on the Oregon coast, and 100% of those in the high cascade in Eastern Oregon fall in that category. We employ high school kids, college kids, and guarantee them a 3-month job, whether we need them or not. And there's no way that we can pay $2.10 an hour. The only thing we can do would be to go to convenience food, make a checkout counter, like Safeway stores, and cut down on our labor by at least 50%, and that isn't the goal that we're trying to achieve. We're trying to make a service industry. But we would be paying higher wages in Oregon, in California, Idaho, Washington, or any such else.
What are California?
I believe it's the $1.75. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I don't know either.
But even if it was at the federal level, tip exceptions, for example, a cocktail waitress can very well make $25 a day on tip in a good place. And it's going to be pretty bad if she doesn't make $10. In many cases, a cocktail waitress or a bartender will make more than the boss. Then you put them, like in my example, I've got four bellhops. By law, I have to pay them the same wage as anybody else. And they get the tip on top of that. See, nobody wants to do anything else, they'd be a bellhop.
That's on your craft.
About a month or so ago, yes. Right. Critter Lake Lodge. Critter Lake National Park. No, but my partner is. I am a half owner of Critter Lake Lodge. The other half owner is Johnny Loriaga, the president of the United States National Bank. He's chairman of the board now, yes. He was president, now he's chairman of the board, that's right.
I remember that thing on my mind when you were referring to yourself as one of those being small business, and I didn't quite get that relationship with me.
Well, he does not work there. He is a stockholder. I am the manager. It's still a small business.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Almost universally, they're families. Father and mother, one or two kids. They're traveling during the summertime when school is out. They vary anywhere from the brown baggers
to young people and one heck of a lot of senior citizens.
I hope you weren't referring to the Whalen family senior citizens.
I just joined the Oregon senior. But the rich people are in the campground.
Good question, John.
I noticed a couple times in your written testimony on page 1 and again on page 3, you indicate that the Senate had not held adequate hearings on this bill, and I suspect when they had a hearing on the 31st of January, a work session on February 7th, and on February 20th, the bill was re-referred by the full Senate back to committee. We had a hearing on March 5th and sent it out and recast the amendment. And so I was wondering what, if there was something that you especially felt was inadequate about the hearing.
Well, as all I know is that I never saw anything in the paper. There was no notification to anybody in the industry that I knew of that hearings were going to be held. I was out of town for 1 week. I was in Washington, D.C. And when I come back, the first thing I saw on the front page of the journal was that they passed a bill after having had hearings for one afternoon, referred back to committee, and passed the following day. And I didn't consider that really.
Any other questions? I can have a
thank you for allowing me to testify.
And Robert Corey.
My name is Robert Corey, 1467 Capitol Street, Northeast Salem, Oregon. The proposed change affects those over 18, but the minimum wage in the past has moved up for those under 18 as well, and it's that group under 18 that I'm most concerned about. We employ over 200 young people as well as many adults. Like most employers, with the high cost of training people, we want to pay the highest wage possible so we can reduce personnel turnover and improve production and service. However, the employer doesn't pay the wage. We write the check. But it is the customer who pays all the wages and all the bills. We have analyzed our operation for the years 73, 74, and 75, and the statistics show as the hourly wage increased, the selling price of our products went up, and the number of man hours went down. In other words, higher wages, less volume, and fewer jobs. Our older employees receive more than the minimum wage. Our experienced employees also receive more than the minimum wage. We are currently covered by the federal minimum wage in most of our units and others by the state. However, everyone in business and non-business alike are affected by the state minimum wage. The main reason cited for increasing the minimum wage is to ensure everyone a living wage. I agree that a family should not live on $2.10 an hour. In our operation, most of the individuals receiving the minimum wage are students living at home without major rent and food obligations or a family to support. It is the extra money for them and the family, but the greatest benefit is the experience they gain in their first job. The minimum wage has priced a lot of young people out of the job market. There is a lot of work to be done. Many people need help in their yards, odd jobs about the house. This is especially true of our senior citizens. Labor cost in business is paid with after-tax dollars. No, labor costs in the business are paid with before-tax dollars. Individuals at home pay for odd jobs with after-tax dollars. Young people don't understand that a law doesn't pay the minimum wage. I repeat, in business, it is the customer who pays. At home, it is the homeowner who pays. We need to keep these young people constructively occupied. They have energy and enthusiasm, and if it is directed in a mischievous way, it results in vandalism and criminal activity, which is costly for all the taxpayers. I think it is more important to the community to have more of them constructively occupied than paying higher wages to a few. Jobs are very important, and if the productivity of the worker is closely related to the pay, there will be more hours available for more people. I am repeating, these students are not heads of family with rent to pay or a grocery budget to meet. Work is a good habit to acquire, and the younger worker gets practical experience. He learns the value of tools, what type of work he might like. He also learns to meet the public. If more young people had jobs, there would be less minimal delinquency. The constantly increasing minimum wage has priced these young workers out of the job market. Case in point, how many box boys have you seen lately in the grocery store? Instead of being overworked, the youth of today are often underworked and not constructively occupied. You've heard many of them say, what is there to do? I think work is a good answer. I've hopefully made my remarks brief. If I can answer any questions, I'd be pleased to.
I'll make it clear that you open up the questions. Do you have a copy of that?
Yes, I can give you a copy.
That's all right. Really good, doesn't have to type it all up in a minute to get submit it. I don't like her to work too hard.
I had a feeling that's what you had back long time. Okay, any questions, Mr. Gentner? Gentner? Is that how you pronounce it?
Pardon?
How do you say
Corey?
Oh, Corey, why?
I'm sorry, I'm difficult. Okay, I'm sorry. I jumped one. Any questions? Yes, not thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Let's see, I jumped on it. Mr. Gentner.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Albert Gentner. I'm a small businessman in Portland. I'm here representing the Portland Hotel Association, the Oregon Hotel and Motel Association, and the Oregon Restaurant and Beverage Association. When Senate Bill 179 passed the Senate and came to that was sent to the House, I wrote to each of you gentlemen, Mr. Ellie, concerning our problems with this bill. My testimony this afternoon basically would be a repeat of the letter. I brought the copies of the letter and the accompanying data with me in case my previous correspondence with you has been mislaid. Senate Bill 179, which has been referred to your committee, would cause serious problems to the hospitality industry if passed in its present form. This bill purports to bring Oregon's minimum wage requirements into conformity with those of the federal government. Actually, it would cause a serious distortion between Oregon law and federal law by ignoring the federal provisions for industries brought within the coverage of the Fair Labor Standards Act 1966, 1972, or 1974. I've enclosed a copy of the operations bulletin from American Hotel and Motel Association listing the, or showing the federal laws that affect the hotel and restaurant industry. The wage and overtime provisions are somewhat lower than those affecting industries which were covered before 1966 and gradually are brought up to be on a par with those industries which were covered before 1966. The reasoning behind this phase-in is that it would avoid a shock or avoid causing any undue hardship on businesses which probably would be unable to absorb the entire wage increase and other changes at one time. Enterprises covered by these provisions include preschools, schools and colleges, hospitals, and other healthcare institutions, laundries, small construction firms, large hotels, motels, and restaurants. There is a provision for this, exempting the smaller organizations which Mr. Payton represents. Motion picture theaters, state, local government agencies, private households, and other small establishments. The tip credit provision of the Fair Labor Standards Act is peculiar to the hospitality industry. I enclose a position statement on tips that was put forth by the National Restaurant Association, which I think probably explains the industry position better than I can. The problem of a gradual phase-in is even greater with those resort hotels which are seasonal in nature and are not covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. Since they are covered by the present Oregon minimum wage, the wage scale increase proposed by Senate Bill 179 would be traumatic. Our association members believe that there is no justification for passage of Senate Bill 179. We feel that with the problems of today's economy, Senate Bill 179 should be tabled under any circumstances. If Senate Bill 179 is passed out of committee, it must be amended to conform with the provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act that apply to industries which were covered by the Federal Act in 1966 and later. In today's highly competitive tourist and convention market, Oregon's hospitality industry must not be put at a competitive disadvantage with other states.
Well, before we open to questions, I would assume there's some people from the school system, OEA, and everything out there. Looking at the clock and judging the time we're going to take on the next bill, and the speaker says we'll be on the floor at 2, so baby, you're dead today. We're not going to make it. I'll just save you time. You don't have to sit and wait. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr.
Gentner, I'm sorry.
I'm confused here because he's talking about the Fair Labor Standards Act. Now, how are we falling under that by going to the higher wage?
Well, now, I don't understand.
Okay, are you saying we're ignoring the provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act?
The hotel industry and restaurant industry are operations that have, I believe it is now 250,000, I take that back. I think it's gone to 225,000 gross now. Gross sales fall under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. Industries that have, operations that have a lower volume than that, operations that are seasonal by nature, are exempted from coverage by the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. Those industries, or those business partners, that are not covered by the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act are covered by the Oregon minimum wage law. Okay. Now, the law at the present time, as of January 1, 1975, provides a $2 hourly wage for those businesses that are covered.
Under the federal.
Now, this is true for businesses which were covered in 1966 or 72 or 74. Now, we happened to come under this in 1966. We've been covered for, 8 years, 9 years. There is a phase-in that eventually, by, I believe, 1977, will have the same minimum wage for hotels that are covered, restaurants that are covered, as opposed to those that were covered previous to the inclusion of the hotel industry. Now, the smaller organization, which is not covered by that, based on this bill, which is supposed to, in effect, bring the state up to the same level as the federal government, does not have this approach, the norm, if you want to call it that.
You're saying you won't fall on this gap then, the far away you hire a state, then you have to, put it some law that says you have to get a higher wage?
No, that is true for Mr. Payton, since he's not covered by the federal law.
Okay.
But Mr. Payton then would be paying $2.10 an hour, and whatever motel or resort along the coast that is seasonal by nature would be paying $2.10 an hour minimum wage, while the Thunderbird at Jansen Beach is paying $2. Now, whether they're paying $2 or not is beside the point. The point is that that is the minimum wage that they would be required to pay under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Did I tell you more than you wanted to know?
I think so. Thank you, Dr. Lawrence.
Any further questions?
I'll get after you.
Thank you.
Wallace? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Walter Lofgren, legislative representative of the Oregon State Council of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees and Bartenders International Union and our affiliated union. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 179. We support the enactment of Senate Bill 179, raising state minimum wage rates from $1.75 per hour to the maximum hourly wage provided by the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 as amended for the following reasons. The present state minimum wage of $1.75 per hour is simply not adequate for thousands of workers in the food, beverage, and lodging industry in Oregon. A worker steadily employed on an average 40-hour week, 52 weeks per year, would earn $3,160 gross. And I might add in passing that there are very few of those workers that work 40 hours, 52 hours, 52 weeks a year. Coupled with an overall 22.6% increase in 1973 and 1974, with 1975 yet to be computed, in cost of living percentages, as provided by the Bureau of Labor Standards Statistics, need I say more, in graphic illustration of the justification of elimination of the disparity between state and federal standards. Coupled with an overall 22.6% increase in 1973 and 1974, with 1975 yet to be computed, in cost of living percentages as provided by Bureau of Labor Standards Statistics, need I say more, in graphic illustration of the justification of the elimination of disparity between state and federal standards. Let me point out to you, a worker getting $1.75 an hour pays the same amount for a dozen eggs that a guy getting $5 an hour does. We see no cogent reason for delaying enactment of this legislation on the premise removal of exclusions in the foreseeable future will standardize federal and state standards. Let me emphasize, the need is now. We respectfully urge the House Labor Business Affairs Committee to recommend a due pass of Senate Bill 179 without amendment. Might I address myself to a few other remarks here?
on this situation. This committee's meeting reminds me of many of the past House Labor Committee meetings that I've attended in the years gone by. We've had the same crocodile tears every time this minimum wage situation is brought up. Small employers cannot afford to pay. Cannot afford to pay high school kids that they hire. Well, I would like to know that a high school kid, if he's not worth the adult pay that he would get for the same doing the same job, well, let me comment briefly. We have operators that get up and say, well, we're small businesses. One of the most recent witnesses here runs, in my mind, a substantial business and would not be too much affected by the increasing the state minimum wage, because I know it to be a fact that he is paying well over the state scale now. We make much of the fact of the tip offset credit, where an employer can take 50% off for gratuity employees in the form of credit. How in the name of heaven can we base anything realistic on a situation like that, when there is so much difference in the type of establishment for the worker works in, the difference of the shift, which influences the amount of gratuities that he would receive? Tips are not a part of the basic wage. They are given as a reward for good service by you, the customer. And I cannot and will not admit that they should even be considered in the deliberations of a bill that the employers want to excuse themselves so they can get out of payment of the basic wage that they should be paying, that they are responsible for. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
The individual that is paid a minimum wage today, do you see that individual as someone working full time at that wage level, or do you see it as someone who is working part time, perhaps supplementing other incomes?
I think Representative Morris is a great many of the workers that are in this type of a bracket that are working part-time to simplify their first to do it, to amplify their present earnings on another job.
Do you see that as a majority of those people at that wage level, or do you see it as a minority?
I think it's a minority.
Do you feel, or do you believe, that if this wage level is adopted, that some people will not be hired, or some people will be removed from work because of the wage level?
No, I do not, Representative Morris. We've heard that same argument down here for years and years.
To whom do you represent?
I represent the hotel and restaurant employees and bartenders in the National Union Oregon State Council.
Is that part of a greater national organization?
We are an international union.
Is your union now currently before Congress asking for an increase in the minimum federal wage rate?
No, our present legislative objective this year is to repeal the tip offset credit.
Has the individual passed been asked for an increase in the federal minimum wage?
There was an act a couple of years ago, increasing.
If there is indeed this growth in the contemplating, why aren't you back to your location back now before Congress asking for an increase? If there is this growth in the
inflation rate, this is tied in. The increases in the federal minimum wage are as follows. Now, on the 1st of January, it went to $2 an hour. The 1st of January of 1976, it will go to $2.20 per hour, and the 1st of January of 1977 will go to $2.30 an hour.
My point is, if the arguments that you have given us today about the cost of increase in living is valid, why Oregon? Why not Congress? What are we doing with little Oregon? Why aren't we before 50 states?
Because I'll tell you the reason why, if you want to open it up. We've got hundreds of employers here in the state of Oregon that actually come under the federal standards, but are taking advantage of the state standards because they don't have to pay as much.
When was, in your business experience, had you been an independent businessman that had employed young people, for example, at a minimum wage level? Have you been an adult?
I have not been in business myself. I am a youth.
You never have been in business?
No. Now, what difference does that make?
Well, I'll tell you what difference it makes. But you made a supposition that the enactment of an increase in the minimum wage would not result in layoffs. Now, let me tell you something. I employ young people at the minimum wage, and I can assert to you, as have other gentlemen, that it will indeed make a factor, and it is indeed something that should be considered.
In other words, you're telling me, Representative Morris, if your minimum wage that you have to pay your employees was increased 25 cents an hour, you're going to have to lay them all off.
I'm telling you there are only so many dollars to work with, and if you keep stacking it up, maybe we ain't going to make it. That's it. That's it.
Good question from Ray Fred.
There was one thing that you said that I think I probably disagree with you somewhat, and that was on the tip. I'm not a big tipper, but one of the reasons I tip is because of the feeling that maybe those that aren't members of a particular organization may look back on. Many that aren't get such a lousy wage.
I agree with you. I think one of the blights on the industry today is the tipping system.
Representative Rogers.
Do you negotiate your contract with your union with
an individual or an individual basis? It depends, Representative Rogers. Sometimes we deal with associations, such as a group of employers represented by an association. Some localities are on an individual basis. It depends on whether the employers wish to band together for association bargaining or if they wish to have a committee appointed.
Do you negotiate with your members
We always take and try to negotiate, and we have to take and include the wages and fringe benefits as part of the package.
So you are hired at the minimum wage. The minimum wage is not going to affect the minimum if it goes up. Because you made a statement about people who are here testifying in opposition to the current pay for the minimum wage, and you're testifying in support, and you're going to be wrong with the minimum wage.
Yes, we have an obligation. We have an obligation to work for the betterment of all workers. It's our job to go out and try to organize the workers. But that does not take and relieve us of the responsibility of representing laboring people, of trying to work for the overall good of all of us. And certainly we know that increasing the economic benefits, the minimum wage, so to speak, of the workers will be to the advantage to the economic betterment of all of the industry. I would like to just close with one statement. I do not believe that if the legislation was passed tomorrow, I went to $2, that there would be one importer that would have to close up shop because of the same such a change in the law.
Do you know how many businesses
have gone bankrupt in Oregon? I know the percentage is way up. I read Daily Journal Times. But when I look at employers such as Rory here, Forgetner, and so on, they're not going to go bankrupt either, because they are good operators. The operator that goes bankrupt, usually there's a basic cause other than the payment of higher wages.
Rep. Penny Wolfer.
The main argument, or one of the things, you
just one second.
I know some of you are waiting for 3043. We're not going to make it either.
One of your arguments, is the cost of living up and down. Now, my question would be, if we base a lot of our things on the average industrial wage, and what I was thinking, what would you think of basing the minimum wage on a percentage of the average industrial wage based on a weekly basis? So, figuring out what it would be so that as the average worker did better than the minimum wage, would automatically go up, and if time came, so let's say one day the cost of living came down, then it would, would come down as well. Would you be opposed to that?
Representative Wolfer, unless I have the figures in front of me, I'm not prepared to answer that question.
Well, really, I'm not asking for a percentage or anything like that, the concept. Would you be hostile to the concept? Or?
Well, it depends on what type of a percentage it was.
Well, I'm saying, let's say the percentage is to your liking. Would you favor that concept?
Possibly.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Wright.
You mentioned earlier that some employers are not on the federal regulation.
There are many employers that do not come within the federal guidelines. In other words, they don't do $225,000 a year to go to business. Those employers are not covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. They come under state standards. There are many employers, such as franchises, the franchise type of operations where they own a whole string of drive-ins. Actually, they would come within the scope of the federal law. But they take advantage of the state law on the single unit.
Out of all people, the veterans and are they all part of the man?
No, they are not. Because of the law. The employers, I would say, many of them recognize that they must, when a union contract is negotiated in the area, they pay the going wage, so to speak. Therefore, that tends to defeat our efforts to try to organize.
Do you think that people who can manage this bit in the restaurant or really tipping about this service?
I think the matter of tipping could well be applied to myself. It's become a way of life. I think I do it automatically. And I think there's a lot of, I'm taking sale further, a great many people that they were aware that there was a federal, an offset, where they could take 50% of credit for wages, would not be so free with their tips.
Would you think that if I would have a small restaurant, and you raise the minimum wage, when you need so many people on a job, you cannot do it.
So,
point I'm making that any increases in the cost of your operation are necessarily going to have to be passed on to the consumer to adjust.
Any further questions? That's been said. We have other people that we heard. Peter Blood.
I also have some additional information that I felt I wish to hold an image.
Is there any further questions? Okay, thank you, Howard. Carl, Howard, and Dean will get you probably a week from today. But we're going to have to adjourn and head to the floor. So we'll start out a week from today at 8:30 in the morning with this bill. We're adjourning.